Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is happening to journalism in the 21st century, and does solid, ethical, professional reporting have a future anywhere near as vibrant as its history? Many major daily newspapers have cut staff in recent years. Others have shifted to all digital publication. And television networks are reducing news budgets and shuttering overseas and regional bureaus. But while the financial picture is often bleak, few would argue the work of trained journalists is any less critical than it has been in the past. And some news organizations are taking bold steps to adapt to changing media environments while preserving depth and quality. David Folkenflik is a media analyst and correspondent for NPR News, and he's editor of the new book, Page One, Inside the New York Times and the Future of Journalism. David, welcome to Think.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
So your inspiration for writing this book was the amazing documentary by Andrew Rossi and Kate Novak about the future of the New York Times and of journalism, by extension, the rest of journalism. That was shot mostly in 2009. And at that time, lots of people, for the first time ever, were talking about the theoretical possibility of the New York Times ceasing to exist.
Well, it certainly wasn't unthinkable. I mean, think back to the time that we're talking about. We're saying President Obama has just taken office several months after the collapse of Lehman Brothers, and you're seeing major institutions being taken over by the government or failing. This is a time when the Tribune Company, the owner of the Los Angeles Times, the Chicago Tribune, my old newspaper, the Baltimore Sun, is now in bankruptcy, a combination of economic forces and some very bad choices. And things are in play. The New York Times in journalism is, of course, seen as the gold standard, particularly in print, not just here, but around the world. You'd be surprised at how strong the name brand is. And yet there were people, Michael Hirschhorn in the Atlantic especially, who had said the Times could go belly up.
And Hirschhorn really was saying this so that people would start to think about it. There were those who thought, well, it's important to at least consider the possibility. And there were also those who were just offended that he would even say these things out loud.
Well, I took it as, to be honest, sort of a stirring the pot kind of column.
Uh-huh.
It seemed to me equal mixture of mischief and analysis. But he's a very smart guy. He's been in the media space in a variety of different roles. And in fact, think about what the New York Times did. It took two steps to try to give itself some, to extend its financial well-being. One of them was that it had just constructed this gorgeous new headquarters about maybe six blocks from where I'm sitting right now in the midtown of Manhattan. And what it did was it sold the rights to the building, or to much of the building, to a developing company, and then leased it back over the next 10 years. And so it got an infusion of, hundreds of millions of dollars, and it's paying rent now on the ability to be in a building that is its own. It does have the right in 2019 to buy the building back, and I think it's $250 million, but that was a pretty major and humbling thing to do just as it had finished moving in. The second thing it did was it went to a guy named Carlos Slim, who's one of the wealthiest people on earth. He's a Mexican telecommunications tycoon, and it borrowed money from him, $200 million as well, at what you might consider usurious rates, something like 14% a year. Astonishing to borrow that kind of money at that kind of rate, but it needed to do that to kick the can down the road, and in fact, just some weeks ago, the New York Times company paid off that loan early and in full in a way to signal to investors that they're doing better than expected. They've endured this. And what they really were doing was they were pushing their crisis away by about, call it a year and a half to 2 years, at a time when they were betting the credit markets would be a little easier, which they are, when advertising would come back, which to some degree it has, and when the New York Times would figure out new sources of revenue, as we've seen earlier this year with the institution of their blended paywall.
Yeah. Let's talk about that paywall, because it's relevant not only to the New York Times, but also to one of our hometown papers here in North Texas, the Dallas Morning News. It's remarkable to learn how much fierce debate there is over whether this will save or doom the publications that put paywalls in place.
Well, you're seeing a lot of news organizations publicly, a lot of them made fun of the New York Times. They said, listen, it's great that the Times is this gold standard, but the reality is, unless you're providing information that people can't get any other way, something like, or something that they desperately need for business purposes, that is something they can make money off of.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, the Wall Street Journal has what's considered the most successful paywall, although it's a blended paywall. Some of it people can access for free. Bloomberg News provides news for free on its cable channel and also on its website, but they have all kinds of very high-end customized data services and feeds that businesses and investors in particular rely on, and they charge a heck of a lot of money, about $2,000 a month for access to those terminals. That's the kind of paywalls that have worked. News organizations, you know, if some of them tried it, the New York Times has tried, I think this is its third effort to do it. It did it once, trying to charge readers who are accessing the website internationally when it first started its website in 1996. That came down, I believe, in 1997. It tried for a few years to put its high-end, very famous columnists behind a paywall, that is the Maureen Dowds, the David Brookses of the world. And among those rebelling against that were the columnists themselves, who were angry that they were being taken out of a wider circulation. Mm-hmm. They seem to have hit on a model now that it's a hybrid. You can get there. You can read, call it, 5 articles a month for free, and you can click on the links of your friends on Twitter or Facebook, and that won't count against that 5-article thing. But for a select layer of readers who go to the site repeatedly, they think readers will either be willing to subscribe to the print edition or pay extra just to get a cheaper rate to subscribe for their iPad or their computer. And it seems to be paying off so far.
Well, David Carr, who is the media reporter for the New York Times, has a fabulous essay in the book and reminds us, among other things, that the New York Times is a different paper depending on who you talk to. Some people go there for the architecture coverage and other people go for the technology coverage. And therefore, it would make sense that people are willing to pay for these things that they feel they can't find elsewhere.
Well, the New York Times is essentially a daily high-end magazine of analysis, features, sports, culture, business, finance. I think it is far and away the finest newspaper in the country, and arguably the best in the world, although there are others that have their own favorites. I think it's an incredible combination. Regardless of your feelings, you know, some people feel that it may be too geared towards a cosmopolitan outlook. Some people feel it may be outright liberal, but what it does is a tremendous thing. You know, it functions almost like a very high-end department store where they're trying to do everything for everyone. General interest publications have had trouble selling, you know, putting their things behind a paywall because ESPN now offers fantastic sports coverage, and it has a terrific stable of writers now with the development of ESPN, the magazine, as well as its website. You can go to the Journal or other, you can go to Yahoo Finance for financial quotes. You know, you can go to Business Week online and see a lot of their things. You can go to the New York Daily News online and see things that are happening in New York. For every slice that they have, somebody else offers something that approximates it. And if you really don't want to pay hundreds of dollars a year to access the Times' content, you can get pretty good facsimiles for politics, for business, for sport, for other things.
David,
that's the challenge they face.
Yeah, you mentioned the value of analysis, and it can come from a variety of different sources. Matt Thompson writes here about the dangers of the current emphasis we have in this 24-hour news cycle on breaking news as somehow more important than in-depth understanding of events around the country and around the world.
Yeah, and I love Matt's piece, and I'm also very fond of Matt. He's a colleague here at NPR, but he's done some real thoughtful work at other places as well. He, in a younger incarnation, had helped develop this website about local culture and arts for the paper in Minneapolis, and had made sure that it was tied into various social media in ways that allowed content and assessments from readers to help propel that. You know, what Matt writes about in this is he calls it the tyranny of the new in news, and that is that sometimes the most important stuff that's happening with news developments are actually dynamics that are playing out over time or have been the case, and that people aren't stopping to sort of take a moment and say, you know what, we should really explain what this is about. You know, until we started really getting close to this debt limit issue, the question of the debt limit expiring and are not being able to raise more money, people weren't really breaking down what these things were about. They were talking about the daily debate over what should be done. Sometimes what needs to be done is explain, here's the field of play. Here are the issues at stake. Here are the institutions involved. Here are the dynamics driving them. And that can be just as useful or more useful. I think my colleagues who sit nearby here in New York at Planet Money do an excellent job not only of playing off what the headlines are, but what the what the threads are that are really driving the news.
I guess the problem with that sort of coverage is that it takes a matter of hours or even days to put together something that really cogently explains a subject that's very complicated, and you don't have that thing that seems to tell people that you're doing a good job, which is, you know, every 4 minutes a new fact being posted somewhere.
Well, and I think that you're seeing more news organizations say, we're not going to do it all. We're not going to do everything at every moment. We're going to, there's a phrase from Jeff Jarvis, who's a scholar here in New York, thinks a lot about media. He was one of the driving forces behind Entertainment Weekly, so he really is, he's been a practicing journalist as well as scholar. But he says, do what you do best and link to the rest. And the notion is that you're seeing a lot more collaboration. You're seeing a lot more sharing. You're seeing a lot more linking in online news presentations. You can't do everything around an issue. For major news organizations like The Times, like NPR, perhaps The Wall Street Journal, there are fewer and fewer of them, I might add. We do try to play at a variety of levels. We try to have those one-minute spots at the top and bottom of every hour that give you a little update as to what's happening. We try to have the news and analysis on the big programs. And then we try to make sure to let people break off and take time to explain things. And it can take, I mean, forget hours. It can take days. It can sometimes take a few weeks. And when the story's right, you try to break off and have the time to do it and make sure that we have enough of a horsepower here to be able to cover the other stuff.
Since you talk about collaboration, we should get to the essay by Evan Smith of the somewhat fledgling, I guess it's been around for a while now, the state news site, the Texas Tribune. They came in hoping and expecting to forge these cooperative relationships with for-profit newsrooms that might be struggling, but had a tough row to hoe simply convincing publishers and news directors to trust their intentions.
And I thought that was a very interesting story. If you look at his site at the Texas Tribune, it's lively, and it highlights a number of their partnerships. They have a partnership with, I believe it's KUT, our member station in Austin, that's done some very good work, but also is enduring in that they share one of the political reporters there, and it makes sure that the content from Texas Tribune is heard by the listeners also of KUT. But he encountered some resistance, and he was surprised because he was essentially saying, this is free, folks. This is stuff that you guys can review. We can talk to you about the standards we get there. You know, we can start to do things in collaboration ahead of time, so we're not just offering you already baked projects, but figure out what issues are most important for your readers. And editors were resistant. But it speaks to what has been historically a very strong, particularly newspapering, but strong journalism culture. I mean, you've got a terrific investigative journalism culture, I think, at KHOU in Houston. WFAA is a fine television station also there in Dallas. Really good journalism throughout Texas. And these people were used to clobbering the heck out of their peers and rivals. The notion that in times of diminished resources, when even a paper as dominant as the Dallas Morning News says, we are no longer going to cover all of Texas, we're going to pull back. It was an apt moment for Evan and his partners at the Texas Tribune to step in and say, okay, well, let's do things together that are more than just I run yours and you run mine, but that add to a greater concerted focus on some of the issues that are getting overlooked here in Texas.
I guess what you do have to give up is the sort of monopoly on the story if you have broken something in a partner situation.
That's right. And the question is, if that's the end of the world. I mean, there are a heck of a lot of papers that have been running a heck of a lot of Associated Press copy for years, you know, and sometimes that would be acknowledged. And sometimes you might say from, you know, such and such newspaper wire reports. But really what that means is that somebody else has done the work and you've used it. That's a form of sharing. The Dallas Morning News and almost every newspaper of consequence in Texas belongs to the AP, or at least has until recently. And they pay for it. It's a membership organization, a little bit like NPR. But that said, this is the notion of sharing is a little tougher. You've seen it more done in newspaper chains like the Tribune Company, where you've seen, you know, Baltimore Sun stories running in the Los Angeles Times and vice versa.
Let me jump in here for a second, David. We need to take a quick break.
Ma'am.
My guest is David Folkenflik, media correspondent for NPR News and editor of Page One, Inside the New York Times and the Future of Journalism. Join the conversation now by calling us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is media correspondent for NPR News, David Folkenflik. He's editor of the new book, Page One, Inside the New York Times and the Future of Journalism. It was inspired by the documentary film, Page One. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. I want to shift the conversation a bit, David, and talk about the fascinating questions raised by the presence of WikiLeaks in this evolving world of journalism.
Sure.
Suddenly, we're in this world where civilians can gain direct access to content without having it mediated even by qualified professional journalists. But it's really hard to make a blanket judgment as to whether this is a good thing or a bad thing.
Let's just say and agree that it's a thing. I think that it can't but be good that the barrier to publishing has been lowered, mm-hmm. that people can share information. But that said, people can also share exceptionally sensitive information. WikiLeaks has been the target of scorn, not just for embarrassing the U.S. military with revelations and more recently the State Department and other foreign officials through the publishing of confidential cables. But, it also in the past did things like published cables that identified people in Afghanistan who would help the U.S. government as fixers or given information, things that presumably if people affiliated with the Taliban, have access to computers and the web, which we know that they do, they can read too and can, exact retribution. And it's the kinds of, these are the kinds of facts that news organizations, despite wanting to hold our own government and others accountable, may be very tentative about doing without cause because, you don't want to put people's lives in peril. So the issue was very interesting when WikiLeaks came along and the New York Times decided to collaborate with them, basically through a partnership with the British newspaper The Guardian. And, I talked with Bill Keller several times about the relationship, and he said adamantly, WikiLeaks is a source, it is not a partner, and they are not journalists. That said, Julian Assange, the charismatic and shall we say provocative leader of WikiLeaks, himself gave himself the title of editor-in-chief, which suggests an editorial vision and role, even as he acknowledged that he was, even as it acknowledged that he had a strong advocacy point of view, he was not only opposed to secrets and secrecy, which he's almost an anarchist about, in his opposition, but he's also very much opposed to U.S.-led involvement in Afghanistan and particularly Iraq.
There were also some really interesting references in multiple essays in the book to the issue of Wikipedia, which most people do not think of as a journalism site and which doesn't create original content. It takes things from other publications and aggregates them. But it's becoming more and more an increasingly important resource in taking breaking coverage of news and putting it in one place for people to find.
I think it's a good resource for people to learn a little bit more. You were talking about Matt Thompson's talk about the tyranny of new in news. If somebody dies or there's a policy debate or something happens in Oslo in Norway, if you go to Wikipedia, you will find a pretty good reading on, what's the, is immigration a big issue right now in Norwegian politics? Now, you will end up getting a very quick, wonderful piece from the BBC and the New York Times, and we'll have good analysis and all kinds of great resources journalistically, but they already have that stuff up most of the time. And, it's very useful. But, my mother teaches freshmen at UC Irvine in California, and she always say to them, yeah, you can use Wikipedia, but, that's a starting point, not an ending place.
Sure.
It's a place where what I like to do when I use it is I read this summary on something I may not know anything about, and then I look at the footnotes.
Yeah,
and then I click to those places that are the footnoted sources, and then I springboard off those to original documents, and suddenly you may be gaining more of a control of knowledge in the situation and not having to rely purely on it. But as a, it's the genius of the hive mind. As hundreds of people come together to add some information, I would not say it is something I would rely on. I certainly would not rely on it to go to air. I do remember when Tim Russert died, I had two sources at NBC confirming it for me, but before I was even able to get to air, and before it was in any website, it was already in Wikipedia.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Let's go to the phones now, and we'll speak with Ron in Richardson. Hey, Ron.
Hi. Excellent program. Great topic. I want to talk about the fox in the room nobody's mentioning and kind of focus on Mr. Folkenflik's coverage of Fox News.
Sure.
On March 29th, you wrote a column about Bill Samuelson, who bragged that he had fabricated the claim that Barack Obama was a socialist. And you described it, your headline was, Fox exec admits to mischievous remarks about Obama. In the story, you quoted Sammons four times, and not one single quote by any critic. You then closed the story, quote, Sammons says he just wants to make sure both sides of every story are covered. Then you did, in a prior story you did on Roger Ailes, in which you said he had apologized for calling NPR Nazis. You again quoted ex-Fox employees, did not quote a critic, and in fact left out the fact that his apology wasn't an apology to NPR. He wrote a letter to the Anti-Defamation League. I'd like to quote...
Well, you know, Ron, I think we've got your point, and I think we definitely understand your criticisms of David's coverage. It takes us a little afield of what we're talking about today, but David, I'm sure you'd like to respond to some of that.
I have no problem addressing this. I want to make sure that I want to allow him to frame the question so I can answer it precisely.
Okay, let's do that. Ron, rather than go into your quote, can you go directly to your ultimate question for David for us?
Well, first, this is material. Roger Ailes said, I'm writing this just to let you know some background and also to apologize for using Nazi... when in my considered opinion, nasty, inflexible bigot would have worked better.
Right. So
this is how this is connected. Okay, Fox News has done more to denigrate and degrade journalism in America, and your coverage of them has done nothing but enable and encourage that behavior. Fox is systematically trying to destroy NPR, and NPR doesn't fight back. Why should I defend NPR when you won't do it?
Well, so there's your question, and I think that's a perfectly fair question. You're saying, why should you fight to protect NPR? It sounds like you feel some affection for the network and that you're a listener, and I appreciate that. I appreciate your close listening and reading to my coverage. I think you would find if you went back on the website that I have, on many occasions, including in spots and in stories, made very clear, first in terms of the precise thing you're talking about, that Ailes did not apologize to NPR. Ailes apologized to the head of the ADL, which is a different thing. And that he got off a blast calling NPR executives bigots as his way of apology, which is nobody's idea of what an apology is. And I have no problem saying that out loud. I believe I've said that on our network a number of times. The second thing is you're talking about this, again, the precise thing about Bill Salmon. Salmon was caught in a deeply embarrassing thing. The mischievous, if you look at the headline, which I don't believe I wrote, but maybe I did, whatever, is Fox execs admits to mischievous remarks about Obama. And the mischievous is in quotes. That's his. We frame this story as, essentially, this is an embarrassment and a complication for Fox, which amid being, in my mind, much tougher on Obama than it certainly had been on Bush, but deciding that it was going to be more of the voice of the opposition when Democrats took control in 2009. Despite that, they've hired as a guy, Vice President for News, a journalist who'd been quite conservative during his tenure at the Washington Times and written books that were lacerating about liberals and about Democrats. And this was an instance in which the Vice President for News, essentially the managing editor of the Washington Bureau, was found saying essentially that he... publicly engaged, this is his words, in what I guess was some rather mischievous speculation about whether Barack Obama really advocated socialism, a premise that privately I found rather far-fetched. Now, that is that I'm doing an entire story on the basis of, was he being, even in his own characterization, mischievous, and essentially blowing out of proportion some rhetoric from President or then-candidate Obama, as though he had advocated socialism, even though he found that to be a far-fetched notion. This was not a happy story for Fox. They provided Salmon to us. We were, I believe, the only broadcast element and possibly the only news outlet that they allowed Mr. Salmon to talk to for it. I was important to press him on it and yet to allow people to hear it for themselves. The way in which I think, and I'm not speaking on behalf of the network because I cover the network and therefore I try to not do PR for it in that sense, I think the network lives up to its values in the sense that in covering Fox News, in covering NPR, I try very hard to say, what is the news here? What are the facts? What do people need to understand about it? And how can I let them have the full understanding of the texture and context and still have the ability to respect their intelligence by letting them make up their own minds. It doesn't sound like, from listening to these stories, you had any doubt about what happened.
Let me ask you this, David. It seems as if it's an externally created dichotomy that pits NPR on one side and Fox on the other, at least external of NPR. And I should note, I don't work for NPR. I work for a local affiliate.
Sure.
But does that sort of put NPR and its employees in a position of having to sort of defend themselves against accusations that someone else might make that they are sort of out to get one side or the other? Does that make sense? Am I phrasing this correctly?
Well, let me put it this way. Roger Ailes is the creative genius behind Fox News, and there clearly was an audience for the idea that the mainstream media was not serving their interests. Now, remember, Fox News serves what is essentially a niche. It's the largest niche on cable news, and it's one of the largest niche even on cable TV, but by and large, we're reaching a much greater audience than they are here. But what they have is there are people who are interested in the news. They present it in an entertaining, lively, zippy way. But they also, certainly are catering to the notion that stories are overlooked or overhyped by the media because it somehow denigrates the middle of the country. It is disrespectful of Christians of faith. It is disrespectful of people of older conservative values. The network is entirely geared to play it on that. It's not just that they pick stories that way. It's they continually feed the notion that this is the case. So, when NPR gets attacked by Fox, then when NPR covers Fox, it's accused of somehow, having a grievance
mm-hmm.
because it's covering an institution or a company that has attacked it. I don't think, that's the way I look at it. The way I look at it is, it's one of the leading news presences in the country. They've reshaped the cable news landscape, and they deserve coverage, and we're not going to be deterred by that. I think if you talk to Fox, you would find there are many stories they're very unhappy about. In this case, they were seeking, the Bill Salmon case, they were seeking to contain a scandal. But, as Jon Stewart and others have noted, when the Juan Williams thing broke out, which is the backdrop against which much of this is happening, Fox used its airwaves to launch essentially a news assault on this network in a way that NPR did not do in response. I think it shows its values by not doing that. We certainly covered it fully. I broke most of the stories on that episode, which was a deeply unhappy time for the network.
Yeah, that must put you, and obviously you go into this as an unbiased journalist, but that must put you in an interesting position when you're covering people that you have seen in the hallway and maybe sat across from in the cafeteria.
It's very tough. It's painful on a human level, and it's difficult as a journalist. But I think the thing that I'm most proud of is the network, while not always perfectly happy with it, was very respectful of the need of working journalists, myself and a couple of editors who were sort of sequestered and allowed to decide what's the news and to try to do it to the very best of our abilities. That's it. I mean, I first interviewed Juan before either of us was ever at NPR, and we had always had a cordial rapport, and I this whole thing is unfortunate, but there are things large and small, no doubt, that played into what happened. But, for the network, it's important. This isn't a game for us. We take the news seriously, and we try to cover it seriously even when, and we hope it's not that often, but even when it's ourselves.
So let's shift gears here. I found the essay by Secretary of State Hillary Rodham Clinton fascinating. First of all, did that originate as an essay that she wrote, or did she sort of speak to someone and the interview was transcribed?
She was testifying before a Senate Committee on Foreign Affairs, mm-hmm. and I was particularly struck by the almost unreserved terms with which she described the value that Al Jazeera provided to its viewers in understanding events that were occurring in Arab and Muslim nations, particularly, during what was earlier this year, the Arab Spring. And I reached out to one of her spokesmen and said, look, I'm working on a project, and this testimony obviously is in the public domain, but, I just wanted to alert you if there are any issues you have with it that we're intending to incorporate it. He said, that's a great idea. Do it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, we condensed it slightly, but it's all her words. You've got to remember, Al Jazeera is a network that has driven the U.S. nuts, that particularly in the early part of the aftermath of the 2001 attacks on the U.S., people saw it as being somehow in concert with Osama bin Laden and his henchmen at Al-Qaeda. because it received and broadcast videotapes that were believed to carry not only threats to the West, but perhaps messages to followers. You know, over time, even under President Bush, officials would speak to Al Jazeera because that was the best way of reaching viewers in the Arab and Muslim world in a way that wasn't seen as on a propagandistic or state-controlled news organization, mm-hmm. although obviously it receives most of its funding from, or I think basically all of its funding from the Emir of Qatar. So, you know, it was a useful vehicle. For Hillary Clinton, for people I've spoke to who were in the State Department as the Arab Spring was playing out, they just said, look, you know, Al Jazeera was 2 days ahead of the American press at minimum mm-hmm. on all this stuff. It took a good 36, 48 hours to understand what was happening in Egypt, but it did so days ahead when you saw the Western press talking about, Mubarak has been a steady ally of the U.S. It's all the Muslim Brotherhood driving this. People there will tell you, journalists there will tell you that this is, clearly was an uprising and a more organic one than anything linked to the Muslim Brotherhood's intentions that they tried to perhaps link into that. But that this was a much more organic thing. And I think people got, you saw MSNBC at times just flip over to video footage from Al Jazeera because its people were nowhere near in place.
Yeah, well, it's an interesting contention that she makes, too, that Al Jazeera is news gathering, whereas a lot of U.S.-produced news these days, or what is called news programming, is in fact a lot of discussion and argument-based programming as opposed to presentation of facts.
Well, I think that's exactly right. But I think Fox News demonstrated that news is expensive and talk is cheap. And that was something that Roger Ailes knew for decades, when he was creating what became CNBC. And he also created a channel called America's Talking that I think is what, in a sense, turned into MSNBC ultimately. It's much cheaper to have three people arguing at each other, even if one of the people is an overpaid host, than to have a team of reporters out producing compelling stories. Even CNN, which has by far the most muscle power and muscle knowledge internationally in terms of breaking news, it takes it a little while to get its feet. I think you see a real difference between the talk and the reporting.
I'm so sorry, David. We need to take one more quick break. Let me jump in here.
Sure.
David Folkenflik is with us. He's media correspondent for NPR News and editor of Page One, Inside the New York Times and the Future of Journalism. Back in a moment. Our number, 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a self-designed program that allows an unconventional approach to your graduate education. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is David Folkenflik. He is media correspondent for NPR News and editor of the new book Page One, Inside the New York Times and the Future of Journalism. It's inspired by the documentary film Page One. Before we took a break, David, you were talking about CNN as the largest, perhaps, international effort in terms of television news coverage, but still having some limitations.
Well, it's that they'll do great for 2 or 3 days when an event is actually occurring. And you saw a nice uptick in ratings for CNN during the Arab Spring, as it's now called, mm-hmm. Earlier this year. And yet, as the headlines fade and the news goes away and they start just pulling people in to talk, you know, as days elapse, it just kind of reverts back to the mean. And you see sort of a talk, a back and forth. It very quickly goes along ideological lines. I thought that they actually had a lot of fairly high-level discourse about what was happening and some very good reporting by folks there, Ben Wiederman and Nick Robertson and Ivan Watson and others. But when the headlines fade, CNN is sort of has been typically in recent years at a loss for what to do next, whereas Fox and now MSNBC, I find, know what they're doing. But what they're doing is less journalistic.
Well, in terms of less journalistic, that's also been a criticism levied at the Huffington Post, which in many cases, some people will say it has this sort of parasitic approach to providing news because it's been gathered by other outlets and then people comment on it. Jim Bankoff, though, in your book, writes that the Huffington Post ultimately helps to validate the original news sources that it references.
Well, Jim Bankoff is a guy I've known for years, and he's a wonderful, smart guy. He doesn't come at this as a journalist. He comes at this as an entrepreneur. He had been a senior executive at AOL on the online and browser side some years ago, and then he migrated and encouraged them to think about getting into content. And when they did not create greater content, he created something called SB Nation, which is a network of fan-focused blogs covering all the major sports, and it's really interesting. It's basically a way of saying, okay, we're not going to have all of the athletes and all of the famous people of ESPN, but we're going to pick the best, in their minds, fan-generated sports blogs about major teams and all the major sports, and then we're going to build content around it. And it's pretty interesting. He also advised Arianna Huffington a bit about what she was doing. And then, of course, Huffington Post has been bought by AOL, and so they're getting back in the content business. But his claim is, look, AOL does it has a modest stable of known reporters, of established reporters. It's got a larger stable of people it pays a modest amount for essays and things. And it's got a ton of people who they don't pay anything. But what they really do is they aggregate things. And they slap headlines on things that get you to look at it. And for people who go to its page, if you're with the Washington Post, is it better that they do link to you or don't link to you? You know, Bill Keller has picked a couple of fights with Arianna Huffington. He sees what she does as parasitic. He's, of course, the executive editor, about to step down next month of the New York Times. And what Jim Bankoff says is, listen, these people are going to the Huffington Post anyway. So either the Huffington Post can say the New York Times has the best coverage of what's happening with the debt ceiling debate, and therefore we're going to link to them, even if it means that we'll include four or five paragraphs and a headline and a link, and not everybody will click on the link. Or they can go to the Financial Times, or they can go to the LA Times or someone else, and then they don't even get the reference. Would you rather have them validate your brand and send some traffic your way or not? And I think there's a fair debate about how far you can go with aggregation before it becomes theft. But I think Jim makes a very cogent point in what we call the link economy, and that is you can't want people to sever you from linking into you, otherwise you become isolated.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phones to Brett in Louisville. Hello, Brett.
Hey, Chris. How you doing?
Great, thanks.
Good. My question is, I'm curious on how you feel about opinion being presented as fact and the very loose use of the term expert when people refer to people in news articles now. I think that's where I find the most frustration.
And you're talking about in print?
In print, actually, in print and media, radio
broadcast.
And television, yes.
Well, I think you're seeing a lot more analysis and a lot more. You're seeing a lot more point of view. The real question to me is how things are labeled. I had a publisher in Baltimore who once said, "I don't care if you write news stories, analyses, and commentary, but they better all be labeled so the reader knows what he or she is getting." And then you want to think about, you know, where you want to position yourself in terms of, do you really want to do all of those, play all of those roles? I think that we struggled a little bit with, you know, are we comfortable with analysts straying into personal opinion, or are we interested in them just sort of explaining the landscape? I think expertise needs to be unpacked. If somebody says so-and-so is an expert in this, like, tell me why. Like, what have they done? You know, what have they worked on? I think that's a totally valid point. And I think that sometimes, particularly on cable, people go far afield from expertise and present opinion as, or gut instinct as fact. And I think that's dangerous. It's not harmful. I mean, I certainly value, I think the Weekly Standard has some wonderful stuff in it. I think The Nation or Mother Jones has some wonderful stuff in it. Those are opinion publications, and that's fine. But you know where they're coming from, and I think that's fine, too. I went to the UK last December and did a couple stories that appeared in January, and one of them was about the notion of, well, in the UK, it's the networks, Sky News and the BBC, which are much more straightforward and much less opinionated. And it's the newspapers that all sort of openly embrace particular points on the ideological spectrum. They still have a distinction between their editorials and their news pages, but the stories they pick, the approaches they take, their headlines are very much playing to a specific element of the audience. And I think that that's sort of this inversion, this mirror image of the way the U.S. market is tries to work.
I want to talk about the role of philanthropy in journalism moving forward. Certainly, you at NPR, we at local affiliates benefit heavily from philanthropy, but there are also sort of upstarts like the Texas Tribune and even some for-profit companies that are looking for philanthropic gifts to advance what they're trying to do as journalists. I mean, do we have to be careful about what we accept and if anything is tied to this philanthropy?
Well, I mean, take a newspaper like the Dallas Morning News. You know, they have for years, required people to pay for subscriptions. But what they're really doing until recently was that was not the primary source of income. The primary source of income was from advertisers.
Sure.
And similarly, as from advertisers, people who give grants to NPR or to KERA or to other elements in public media, not-for-profit media, they have to create firewalls between what people fund and what gets heard on the air or seen in print or online. And that can be tricky because sometimes you're saying we'd like to cover the environment or we'd like to cover energy consumption issues. And you may get a foundation that has sort of a, if not an advocacy position, sort of a general sensibility about what it thinks about such things are important. And, you know, if you can make the case that, you know, you're not going to be able to influence our stories, but this will aid our coverage, it's understandable. Just as an advertiser might say, I really value what you're doing covering the Texas Rangers, and so I think I want to reach the customers who care about that too. But you have to be clear about where your lines are. What I do think is interesting is occasionally you've found some for-profit news organizations accept money. I believe ABC News took some money from the Gates Foundation to help sponsor certain kinds of coverage of, if I'm not mistaken, it's global health issues.
Mm-hmm.
Now, ABC is part of the Disney company. I mean, they got a ton of money, but they also essentially bought out and laid off a quarter of its staff a year and a half ago. And it was looking for innovative ways to fund certain kinds of projects. That can create some funny issues. I know that there's a chapter in the book by Alberto Ibarguen, who's the head of the Knight Foundation, the largest foundation that's largely focused on journalism in the country. And he was taken aback when one of the ventures he funded, called Every Block, that knitted together all kinds of data about neighborhoods to tell people about their schools and accidents and crime and traffic and just sort of make it all in one place. He ended up selling it to MSNBC.
Hmm.
So suddenly this guy made $5 million off something that he got through philanthropic startup, and that was not what Knight thought would happen and was taken aback, and it said, okay, let's put in some controls so that if that happens in the future, then some seed money is created for another project, or that the benefit of that is open to the public in a greater way. But, you know, it was interesting. I mean, journalism philanthropy is sort of being reinvented on the fly as well, and they're having to confront issues they never imagined.
As newsroom staffs in some places are shrinking, as presences in remote bureaus are being cut, there's pressure on a lot of journalists to produce in more formats than they ever have before. Can you talk a little bit about how the people that you edited for this book and the colleagues that you deal with on a regular basis have responded to that need to produce content, say, not only for their daily piece, but also maybe provide some photographs or write some blog entries along the way?
Sure. I think, every journalist is feeling certain kinds of pressure to be more nimble and more agile in here at NPR, you see journalists who filed radio pieces for years now asked to write, not every time, but a lot more, a web version of what they do. That requires a different discipline.
Mm-hmm.
It requires a different logic. And I speak as a former print reporter. They're just, you construct stories differently. You choose quotes differently. You make points in a different order and context. We went through training, I think, something like two-thirds, three-quarters of our staff went through multimedia training, also sponsored by the Knight Foundation. So I learned how to take photographs. So if we're in locations where we can't get pictures, we can take pictures. We learned about creating sort of rudimentary web pages. I do think that a place like ours, we're finding that it's better for people who have skills in certain areas to focus on those skills and make sure that within the organization we have the skills rather than require everything of everyone. But David Carr, you know, in his 50s, is now doing a lot of essentially like podcasts. They're like little video or audio takes on media stories of the week that he does with his younger colleague, Brian Stelter. Both he and Brian, who's in his, I think, mid-20s, tweet religiously, almost obsessively, Brian in particular, they're taking advantage of new social media platforms with the understanding that not all of them will endure.
Mm-hmm.
You know, MySpace was once seen as dominant. MySpace is effectively gone from the scene. You think that Twitter and Facebook will stick around, but we're not sure. But what we do know is that media outlets want to reach people however they experience life. So NPR has a Facebook feed now that has, I think, over a million followers. And they don't shove every story into it, but they put a lot of stories each day there. And they, you know, I can tell you every time one of mine goes up there, I get thousands of comments on there. That tells me that it's being followed pretty closely.
You mentioned that Carr is 55 and his partner Stelter is in his 20s. Is the generation-based technology gap shrinking in newsrooms so that people who have been around for 20 or 30 or 40 years are starting to see what people in their 20s and 30s are talking about?
Yeah, I don't know that the knowledge base is quite the same because, you know, people coming up who are in their, call it late 20s and younger, for them all of this is native terrain.
Right.
But I think that the resistance is gone. You know, in newsrooms, we went through so many years of cuts and layoffs and fear that younger people were being brought in because you weren't going to get it. And now it's seen that it's, as it is collaborative between news organizations, it's much more collaborative within news organizations. And you see somebody like Robert Krulwich, my colleague sitting about five cubicles from me right now, who does all kinds of wonderful stuff online as well as on the air. And he works with young colleagues who sort of envision, okay, how would this look as a cartoon? How can we do this as an audio slide presentation online? How can we just create different components so that these can go viral in different ways and serve a bunch of different audiences, which are not always the same audience, not always the same people?
Hmm.
And there's, I think one of the themes that I really like about the book is there's a sense of excitement about what's possible again rather than simply a lament for what's lost.
What do you think are the ways that people who consume journalism, aside from paying for publications or supporting publications financially that they believe in, what can news consumers do to affect the quality and the tone of the news that's out there?
Well, I think one of the ways is to engage on Twitter, to send in leads and sources to offer perspective. I mean, the audience collectively has more knowledge than any news organization. But, you know, they don't have the time, they don't have the energy, and they don't have necessarily the audience to offer that perspective. You know, there are times where people offer thoughts and or just post things on Twitter and send a link to their personal Tumblr page, and suddenly they've linked video that you didn't know about from Iran during the oppressive protest there that inform your story. You know, we still have to do vetting. We have to be rigorous in our journalism. We can't be lazy and just rely on other people's tweets and Flickr accounts and the like. But we certainly can draw on them as resources. I mean, you know, we call them sources. And you check them out and see what they have to offer. And that is one way that they can be very involved and can have a really positive influence on what's happening.
David, I'm so sorry we're out of time. David Folkenflik is a media analyst and correspondent for NPR News, editor of the new book Page One, Inside the New York Times and the Future of Journalism. David, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Oh, I really appreciate the chance to talk to you and to talk with some of your listeners.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
The Think production team includes engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.